Hey, everybody. Happy Friday. This is Trevin McGee with the Scene Stealers podcast. And we're a man down this week, or a couple contributors down this week. So it's me and the great Trey Hawk.
It feels significantly lonelier.
I know.
Even though you can fill a room with your personality.
You're not the first person to say that. I would like to point out really quick that after doing 62 of these, my elaborate plan has finally paid off, and I was able to trick at least one scene stealer into going and recording the podcast in my room with me. So I finally...
Yeah, you have gotten me into your lair.
Yep, and now there's no way out. Tonight is the U.S. Air Guitar Regional that Mr. Moline is so busy that he couldn't attend. If you get a chance, you know, it's going to be at the Beaumont Club tonight, 10 o'clock. You should go. I'm going to be there with matching armbands and a headband, running the boards and pressing the space bar a lot, probably drinking a lot too, but you know, who knows, that's my business, it's not your business.
We should have a pretty decent KC presence there.
I'm hoping.
So, yeah.
So, you know, if you get the chance, if you haven't already, look us up on Facebook. You should definitely go. It's going to be a blast. But Eric was able to make room in his busy, busy schedule to do a phone interview with me about the Abe Lincoln Vampire Hunter, which he saw earlier this week. So we're going to play that now, and we'll be right back.
Hey, Trevin. What's going on?
Hey, buddy, I just thought I would call since you're so busy and you're too cool to come hang out with us in the studio. I would just call and get your two cents on Abe Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Yeah. Okay, well, this is, I don't know if you know this or not, but this is the same director who did Daywatch and the Nightwatch movies, the Russian director.
Timur Brekmenitov, yes.
Yeah, there you go. I was hoping that you would say his name so I wouldn't have to.
There you go.
So yeah, this is his movie. It's produced by Tim Burton, and they're really using that to sell the movie, which I think is interesting because it doesn't really have that kind of signature over-the-top gothic look that Burton does so well. I think some of the dark scenes with the blue light have that a little bit, but this really isn't stylized in the way that a Tim Burton movie is.
Right.
That said,
and there's no Johnny Depp either, so...
Right, and Johnny Depp's not in it. Right. So... That said, though, the movie is, in its action scenes, as stylized as movies can get. One thing that I guess I would compare it to in the action scenes are stuff like the Matrix sequels, which were not my favorite movies, and the CGI wasn't really there yet, but the choreography and... The movement, like, you know, of bodies together and apart and different parts, you know, like a big sequence with a train on fire and the tracks falling underneath it and the, you know, one thing leads to another. It's very, very clear what's happening. It's like a Rube Goldberg machine contraption where they could have simply shown us one thing, but instead they chose to take the hardest route. And it makes the action scene all the more impressive.
So you were impressed by the action scenes?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, they maybe this movie doesn't have as big of a budget as it should have for the amount of epic kind of proportions it's going for, but the action scenes do thrill, and the vampires are pretty fucking scary.
Yeah.
So what's interesting is the balance of tone. So, you know, the film plays it straight. The characters, Abraham Lincoln, Mary Todd Lincoln, Frederick Douglass, Jefferson Davis, all the people we know from history are plugged into this ridiculous plot about vampires in the South who want to start a civil war over slavery because they keep slaves and they feed on them. And they want to take over the United States. And so not only does Andrew Lincoln win the Civil War, or Andrew Lincoln, Abraham Lincoln win the Civil War, but he stops the United States from being overrun by vampires. And, you know, this was written, the book, it's based on the book by the Seth Graham Smith guy, who did Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, where he did the same thing. He just plugs, you know, the standard kind of zombie plot into a historical book. So the tone is everybody playing it straight. But mm-hmm. the way it's shot and the ridiculousness of the script demand that everybody do that so that when there is a moment of recognition or dry humor, it's recognized. And I think that's right. key for a movie like this. If it was, if it didn't have that kind of wry tone, then it would be, and it was too self-serious, then it would really come off, you know, horribly. But the action scenes are also way too big and way over the top and beyond the scope of what normal humans can do. So it works. It works in a really kind of, you know, entertaining, dumb way, like maybe the way that the Ghost Rider films should have worked.
Right, the second one, or I guess either of them.
Yeah, and then here's the thing. My biggest criticism is that it's a little bit too long. I think a nice, efficient 90 minutes would have been better. There were scenes where it kind of dragged, and you can see that what they're trying to do is they're connecting the dots. They're pulling the moments from history together so that they can put it into this plot. And believe it or not, there's a training montage.
Of course there is. It's got to be.
Where the vampire hunter extraordinaire teaches Abe Lincoln how to wield his axe and kill vampires properly.
Sure.
And yes, you asked me this, or somebody asked me this before, is there modern loud guitar music being played underneath some of the scenes? And yes, there is.
Of course, yes. So, are there any other Lincolnism references? Like, does he say, "I cannot tell a lie, you're dead"?
Tons.
You know, does he do anything like that?
Yes, there's tons of it in there, and it's hilarious because if you, again, delivered completely straight, so you just can't help but laugh at it, but the whole time it's kind of daring you not to. And I found that to be kind of exciting. The actors in it are pretty nondescript. You know, we don't have any big stars in this movie. Dominic Cooper, I think, is the guy who teaches him about vampires. And then Mary Elizabeth Winstead from Scott Pilgrim vs. the World and Death Proof is Todd Lincoln. And from what I've seen of Mary Todd Lincoln, she's way too hot. So, yeah, Abraham Lincoln's mother, killed by vampires. His son, killed by vampires. Right?
No idea.
All the things that we already... You know, that we knew about that happened to his family. Everything's because of vampires.
It's all vampire cause. That makes sense.
And so I guess the last thing I want to say about this is that I predict this is going to be a box office failure. And the reason is that movies that have a sense of humor about their premise, especially horror movies and action movies, if they do have that sense of humor, they usually flop. And I think that people were going to go into this movie. Well, a lot of people will stay away from it because they're going to just say, "Oh, that looks stupid." And I think the people that do go in might respond negatively to how over the top it is sometimes. So I don't know. It's an interesting film, but I'm very into this director's style of action after this and Wanted, which was also a guilty pleasure for me.
Yeah, you mentioned that in. You are the only one on this phone call that feels that way about Wanted.
Out of all of us on the phone call?
Yes, out of everyone on this phone call. Yeah, I don't know. I'm interested in the movie just because it's taken itself very seriously from the very beginning, so I was curious to know if that doesn't wear thin. I mean, really, that's about the only way you could do a story like this is by taking the subject matter super serious, but... That doesn't wear thin, and that doesn't just get to be a chore.
It does. Yeah, I mean, it does a little bit. That's what I was saying. It's about 15 minutes too long. But, you know, it covers a lot of territory from him as a young child to him on his way to the Ford Theater to go see the play. And apparently, I read online about the book. Apparently, in the book, John Wilkes Booth, vampire. In fact, it has the funniest ending of almost anything I've seen all year. I turned to the people sitting next to me and asked them. I had to, like, double-check. Is that who I think it was at the end?
There's, like, a surprise double-take there's a surprise cameo.
Yes.
At the end.
Let's just say it's another historical figure, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay. All right.
You totally want to see this now, don't you?
Anyway, so what's your final Rock Fist rating then?
You know what? I'm going to give it a minor Rock Fist up. I can't go over the top about this movie. It's what it is. It leaves your mind as soon as you leave the theater. But while you're there, it's a good time, and it has some really great moments in it. So it's a minor Rock Fist up. If there was actually any sort of real emotion, poignancy, or even more action scenes, if it was more action-packed as a genre film, I might give it a solid, but I'm going to stick with a minor Rock Fist up.
Okay, so we're back. God, he's just so busy.
He really is a busy, busy man.
Such a hardworking individual. Couldn't take the time to tell me about this any other way.
He's the hardest working man in no business.
I had a friend in college who I kind of labeled the master of sports that weren't really sports, because he was incredibly good at like ping pong
and billiards
and things like that. And Moline is the hardest working man at careers that don't really sustain themselves.
Right, exactly.
You know? So now that we've dogged on our friend who can't defend himself, also I should point out, you guys should stay tuned at the end of the podcast, because I'm going to be able to talk to Mr. Aaron Weber from Dad's Big Plan. He was lucky enough to see Brave, Pixar's new movie, this week, and he's going to review that for me at the end and just tell me what it's like to watch a movie about a young girl trying to find her own feet from the perspective of a dad and a husband. So that should be fun, if I can keep from making fun of him for long enough for him to get his words out. But but now I have Trey here, and that's what's important, is Trey's here, and we're going to talk about Seeking a Friend at the End of the World, which you got to see this week, right?
I did. This stars Keira Knightley and Steve Carell.
Mm-hmm.
And just so I can get this out in the open, I am not a fan of Keira Knightley.
Okay.
I find her very difficult to watch. I think she is consistently I think she consistently overacts.
Mm-hmm.
She's constantly chewing the scenery.
And it's really easy because she never closes her mouth all the way.
Well, that's true. True.
A friend of mine in college, she had this great joke. It's not really a joke, but she would do this just bad British accent. Go, I can't close my mouth. It's impossible for me to close my mouth.
Well, I think she's got two gears. Mm-hmm. I think she's got exceptionally excited or crying.
Right.
But it almost works in this. I will say that. It almost works in this. So the premise of this film is that an asteroid is on approach to Earth, and it's going to be a planet killer. The movie opens with the last attempt to somehow, push this asteroid off course or something, has failed. The crew that went up there, basically the Armageddon crew, unseen Armageddon crew went up there.
Oh, it's not seen?
And, you don't see it. And I'm not spoiling anything. It happens in the first minute of the film.
And the trailers and commercials have basically built that from the very beginning.
So, but that final attempt to push this asteroid off course has failed. And we know in 3 weeks' time, the asteroid is coming and we're over.
It's
21 days, I believe. And that's the way the movie begins. So it really is a look at what people do when they know their time is nigh. And when it is almost over, what do we do?
Right.
And, Steve Carell's character, his wife runs away, like literally just gets out of the car and runs away in the first few minutes. And he's just sort of left, questioning whether he should go to work, which he still does, continue to go to work. His housekeeper continues to show up every week.
Yeah.
Even though he keeps telling her that she can leave and she thinks he's firing her. So there are some really cute kind of interesting moments. Like, what do you do? I mean, when you've built a life and you're in your, middle age.
And Carell can sell charming moments like that. Like, that's one of his strong suits. He does. It sounds really kitschy to say, but he does heart well.
Isn't so much heartful. It's just these sort of understated and confused moments. Because it really is a question of, like, I mean, we can all sit around and introspectively go, oh, well, if I knew I only had 21 days, it's right. like I'd be kicking ass and I'd be riding motorcycles and I'd be jumping canyons and banging chicks and yeah. rocking and rolling.
You just turn into Evel Knievel.
Right, right. Yeah, that's what I would do in the last 21 days. I'd be like fighting a horse and I'd be like kicking some ass and I'd be looking for gold. You know, I was just like, you know, but like we can all come up with that. But it really is more confusing than that.
Right.
And we are kind of creatures of habit. And those sort of daily rituals punctuate our days and kind of, in some ways, give us some brackets and yeah. give our life meaning. And so,
yeah.
so you know, people sort of get stuck even though the end of the world is coming. So Steve Carell's wife runs away.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of ends up talking to his downstairs neighbor, who's played by Keira Knightley. And they strike up a friendship because she's in a bad relationship and she's breaking up with the guy who she's involved with. There is some rioting and looting. Mm-hmm. It's some of the funniest rioting and looting you've seen because it's all of these sort of almost not catatonically bored people, but just like totally stuck to right. their routine, then confused by people rioting and looting in the streets. So it is pretty cute. But at one point, they have to make a break for it.
Uh-huh.
And Keira Knightley is stuck in the States and realizes that she'll never see her parents again in the UK. So she's trying to figure out a way, even though all of the planes have been grounded and there's no more flights at all, period, ever. She's trying to figure out a way to maybe get back to England.
Okay.
So and Steve Carell finds out that about 3 months before all of this happened, that one of his prior love interests, you know, an old flame, an old girlfriend from 10 to 15 years ago, maybe even longer than that, tried to get in touch with him just to see how he was doing, what was going on, and that she confessed that he was the love of her life.
Okay.
So he's going to try and get in touch with this person and also help Keira Knightley's character get to an airplane, get to somebody who may have an airplane.
Okay.
So that's the basic premise. And
so does it become a road movie at that point?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah. It kind of becomes a road movie. And it also becomes, you know, it is, and I'll throw up a spoiler thing, because okay. this is a mild spoiler.
Spoiler dome.
I think you can get it from the from the trailer,
mm-hmm.
but it does become one of those kind of predictable bucket list films wherever there are intergender pairings where it's like, oh, I'm going to go for that one that got away. And then
right.
you realize that the person next to you is the one. That, yeah,
the one
it's like, oh, that's
yeah.
the person who I'm really in love with.
Yeah.
So it does become pretty predictable. And Keira Knightley's character is supposed to be this kind of frenetic, arty person
right.
who's sort of unstable and kind of a pot smoker. And,
yeah.
and so she at least was well cast for that role, even though I still feel like she pushes her character way. I mean, she pushes the acting way too far.
Okay.
But it, at least if you like Keira Knightley, I think you'll be really happy with this. And it is as understated as she can get.
Okay.
I think Steve Carell is really great. There are often times where I am a little skeptical of the chemistry between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think Steve Carell sells it pretty well. And there are a number of lines where even though the story is predictable,
mm-hmm.
he makes you believe the predictability of it.
Yeah, and that's one of the hardest things to do, and when you do it right, it goes almost unnoticed.
Yeah, yeah. It, you know, to me, it would have been much more satisfying if it was a compelling surprise that mm-hmm. you can sell to us.
Right.
You know, you can't just throw in a twist for a twist's sake either. I mean, I think either making it totally predictable or just throwing in a twist just to not be predictable.
Right.
Both of those are kind of cop-outs.
Yeah.
But if you can come up with a compelling twist that still feels really legitimate, That would be the best thing. And that's really hard to do. And this definitely does not do that. It is a relatively predictable ride. But it's still, you know, it's charming at times. Mm-hmm.
How's the supporting cast? Because there's, to just sum up some of the supporting, I know Patton Oswalt's in it, Rob Corddry, Gillian Jacobs from Community is in it. And is it a Chili's or an Applebee's? She's some
it's
server.
It's Frenzy's. But it is like a TGI Fridays.
Okay.
So it's Frenzy's. And that's actually one of the funnier, I mean, because they just go totally over the top with that whole moment.
Okay.
And I mean, they keep going and you're just like, when are they going to like top out on this? And they never do.
Yeah.
Like they actually, Keira Knightley's character and Steve Carell's character actually have to leave because they go too far, like all of the group. Uh-huh. And in fact, Steve Carell is like, I'm surprised you guys are still in business. And he's like, oh, they said we could go home anytime. But, you know, we realized that we're all sort of family now. And so we just decided to keep it going. And, you know, it's way cooler now that it's not so corporate. And he says this as he's walking past one of his coworkers, and he just slaps him on the ass.
Yeah.
And the guy kind of, like, looks around and is like, hey. So, like, they're all just there smoking pot. And, mm-hmm. and in fact, is it Gillian Adams?
Jacobs.
Gillian Jacobs comes over, and she's their server. Mm-hmm. And she's just like, hey, guys. I've been rolling pretty hard, but if you guys stay really cool, I think we can get you some good service and maybe some spin dip. And so, I mean, it's like they just go for it. And they get some great actors in that moment, too, that just are totally over the top and then just never stop. And it's real. I mean, that's a pretty funny moment. But the one thing that I will say is tonally, I was really surprised by this film mm-hmm. because it was actually a lot sadder and introspective than I was anticipating, and than the trailers make it. The trailers are going for a lot of the funny moments,
right?
And there are a lot of really kind of awkward, sad moments throughout this. And it's kind of like if you were trying to make Melancholia into a rom-com, this is sort of what you would get.
Yeah.
So it's weirdly introspective and somewhat funny, but a lot more sad. Steve Carell's character has this troubled past with his father. His mother has died. I mean, this back and forth. And a lot of that has led to his own choices and his failed marriage and all of this other stuff. So, I mean, there's a lot of heady material in this that doesn't come through in the trailer. Mm-hmm. Overall, you know, I think I'm going to give this a minor rock fist up because it doesn't. If it had been able to do something like give me a satisfying non-predictable something or other, you know, ending or middle point where it bumps and then comes back, just something that gave me something of a surprise because I basically got what I thought I would going into story wise, tonally a little more sad than it was funny. And that was surprising tonally, but overall, the story did what I thought it would do.
Yeah.
And I think if it had been more surprising and elegantly surprising, I think I would have gone solid rock fist up. But because of that, I think I'm going to give this a minor recommendation.
Well, good.
And, you know, I do think that if somebody goes to this and is just like, I just don't know, I think somebody could come away saying minor rock fist down. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's kind of going to be one of those on the fence movies if you're expecting it to be funny and it's too sad for you.
Yeah, and they always do that. I mean, they always market his movies, Carell's movies, as, you know, like, hey, it's the guy from 40-Year-Old Virgin. You know,
right.
Like he's kind of got, it's what they have to do if they want to hope to make their money back.
You know,
I remember even the trailers for Little Miss Sunshine, even though he plays like the saddest character in that movie.
Yeah.
You know, they would cut in his like two jokes. He has the entire movie
exactly.
into the trailer.
Well, and even Crazy Stupid Love.
Yeah.
It's like that was definitely a transition film. It's funny.
I mean,
there are some really funny, but most of the funny lines come from Ryan Gosling.
Totally. Yeah.
And Steve Carell's character is actually really tragic and really kind of misguided.
Yeah. Tortured and turned
exactly.
around.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it's like I think if you liked his performance, in Crazy Stupid Love, and specifically the more introspective kind of lonely guy mm-hmm. stuff, then I think you'll be really happy with Seeking a Friend for the End of the End of the World.
Cool.
But yeah, overall, minor rock fist up, minor recommendation. I think this does a number of things well, and it actually, you know, Keira Knightley works better than most of her stuff, than most of the stuff I've seen her in.
Do you think that has anything to do with the director and writer, Lorraine Scarafia, is her name?
Maybe.
This is the first movie she's directed, according to IMDb.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And I mean, I think... You know, I do think for a first-time director, this is a pretty interesting film because it works on a lot of levels. Mm-hmm. It does have some problems, but yeah. It works on a lot of levels. It'll be interesting to see how she develops because she could really go one of two ways. She could start just really cranking out Hollywood garbage.
Right.
Or she could start getting a little more edgy mm-hmm. and taking some more risks. This is kind of in between. But it is a good first effort. I don't know that it's her. I think Keira Knightley was well cast.
Okay.
You know, this is a good role for Keira Knightley because she can kind of be a little off the hook. And there were moments where she did subtle it up a little more, mm-hmm. and I think that was excellent direction. Okay. So yeah, but yeah, overall, minor recommendation.
Awesome. Okay, thanks for swinging by, and now we're going to jump over to Aaron Weber from
Nice.
Dad's Big Plan.
Yay! Take it away, Aaron.
I'm here with Aaron Weber from dadsbigplan.com, and unlike the rest of the Scene Stealers team, he was fortunate enough to get to see Pixar's Brave, or maybe fortunate. I don't know how he's going to react to the movie. But yeah, you got to see it, Aaron, so what did you think, man?
Well, I would definitely put myself on the fortunate side of the fence. In fact, I'm glad my wife and two daughters hadn't had that much to say about it.
Yeah.
Because they saw it a week ago. I was not allowed to go, being press. and my wife was like, "No, it was good." I'm like, "Don't tell me, don't tell me."
Yeah.
It's one of those films that I walked out of and I'm trying to parse in my head, am I as fond of it as I am because of what it achieved or what it really was.
Right.
I mean, you kind of nailed it earlier where it was kind of like, this is Pixar trying to make a traditional Disney film. Yeah. But in reality, it's far more mature and darker than your average Disney film. Mm-hmm. And I'd even argue it's one of the most mature of the Pixar films in regards to what the central relationship really is about. My girls enjoyed it. They thought it was fun, but they're only five.
Right.
So the nuances of the central relationship, which is between this Princess Merida and her mother, Queen Eleanor, mm-hmm. Are a little too subtle for them. You know, they're not there yet.
Right.
But I will say that being married and having daughters, I think I appreciated the film more than before I was at that point.
Right.
Because it really is, this is a, you know, just the short recap of, for those of you who've lived under a rock is, takes place in an indeterminate period long ago in the Scottish Highlands and the Princess Merida, who's voiced by, what is her name? Kelly MacDonald, who oddly enough, we first met in Trainspotting. So that's kind of a weird circle of life.
Oh, right. Yeah.
From Trainspotting to a Pixar film. She plays the headstrong, willful daughter of a Scottish king who is rebelling against her mother's intentions to turn her into a proper young princess. Mm-hmm. And I'll give Pixar and whoever was handling the marketing of this some serious credit because I've seen tons and tons of commercials with lots of clips, but they still managed to hide the central twist and the central thrust of the film.
Yeah, because honestly, I was thinking about it today before we got to talk, and like, I still don't know what the movie's about. Like, I have no idea. I remember the teasers were very vague, and you just saw, I guess it turns out to be Merida, but you didn't even know her name at the time, but, you know, her on horseback and then drawing a bow and arrow against a bear. And then the trailers have made it, you know, like they focus on that relationship and sort of you get some tinges of her independence and what her character's like just from that. But in terms of the actual plot and what occurs in the movie, I still have no idea how the movie plays out.
Which I certainly shan't ruin for anyone because it's a nice surprise. And it's a surprise that it's almost too bad because there are elements of it that are so well done mm-hmm. that I would love to talk about them at length, but I shan't. A couple of things that were really notable about this is the first Pixar film to have three credited directors. So you have Mark Andrews, who was the original co-director, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, Mark Andrews was brought in to replace Brenda Chapman, who was the first female director at Pixar's ever picked, who was fired about halfway through the production due to the only thing they've ever said is creative differences. Mm-hmm. And she was replaced by Mark Andrews, who was a script guy. But the other co-director is Steve Purcell, which gamers should immediately perk up their ears and go, wait, Steve Purcell? Sam and Max Hit the Road? Steve Purcell?
Yeah.
And that, yeah. So he's the other guy doing the direction on this. And it does, it's a film that, while adhering to all the core Pixar ethos of how you tell a story and what you do within that story, it's a very different feeling Pixar film.
Yeah.
But what I will give him credit for is, again, the emotional relationship at the heart of this is the mother and daughter, and that pays off extremely well. Unless you're our friend Alan, who's dead inside. I don't really care. Like, well, because you hate women and your mother. The cast is.
Yeah, you can't make a Scottish movie without Billy Connolly. They just won't let you.
Connolly. Kevin McKidd,
Emma Thompson.
Emma Thompson, Craig Ferguson.
Robbie Coltrane,
yeah. So and then they even got Julie Waters to do a bit part. And then Steve Purcell, actually, oddly enough, has a voice part.
Yeah, he's a crow, I think.
Though I will tell you that if you're doing the normal game of where did they put John Ratzenberger,
right.
it's a blink and you miss it. He's just got like one line.
It's like Sam Jackson in Kill Bill, Part Two.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much, but it's visually it's an absolute feast. Mm-hmm. It's just gorgeous, and animated films are the ones where when we see them in 3D, I go, man, I can't wait to watch this at home on a 1080p. Television that's the right brightness.
Right.
In this case, I don't know if it was the projector or not, but it was a little dull, mm-hmm. so the colors were a little muted, which I felt a little cheated. And worse, it was blurry.
Oh.
Any time the action got too intense, it got a little blurry.
Do you remember what kind of 3D it was? Was it real 3D or... whatever the other one is.
I think it was the real 3D.
Okay.
And
digital 3D, I think is what they call the other one.
Yeah. And it was just, my girls enjoyed it. They liked wearing the glasses and all that.
Sure.
But this isn't a film that hits you over the head with 3D.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I don't think you're going to suffer for not seeing it in 3D.
Yeah.
But definitely see it. It's great. I mean, if you step back and look at it very, very dispassionately,
mm-hmm.
the story is very fairy tale rote.
Okay.
And some of the elements may seem really familiar and cliched in that all the men in this are kind of oversized personalities. They're all kind of goofy and boisterous and loud. But unlike, According to Jim or Everybody Loves Raymond, this is a film that's from the perspective of this little girl and her mother, who they have rules they have to play by.
Right.
So this is them seeing what everybody else gets to do. The dad gets to be the one who gives her a bow and her three little brothers get to be the terror of the castle. Well, she's got to be the proper young lady who only gets, one day a month to go out and be herself.
Right.
So it works really, really well. The laughs are great. There's not any real scares, but there's a couple of good action sequences that are really well done, which unfortunately you can't get into without giving away central bits. But it was just a truly solid, emotionally rewarding film that I think is easily going to become one of my daughter's favorites.
I'm definitely intrigued by Brave. I mean, I was before just because, you know, it's Pixar. And I admittedly, I never saw Cars 2. Everyone kind of steered me, no pun intended, away from Cars 2 just because of, you know, just how bad it was. And to follow Toy Story 3, I mean, anything was going to be a disappointment in the shadow of Toy Story 3.
Yeah.
But that was the last Pixar movie I saw in theaters, and I really didn't want that experience, you know, kind of ruined
sullied.
Yeah. And, but man, just thinking about it, I love it. My big concern though with Brave is, you know, without going into the spoilers and everything, you talked about some of the things that work really well with the movie and some of the things that don't. You know, being someone who isn't married, doesn't have children, you know, I was able to relate to Toy Story 3 because I was everyone can relate to that movie depending on which stage of their life they're in, because it encompasses all of them. If you're a kid, you can relate to the little girl that's getting the toys and still has that imagination. If you're in your teens, you know what it's like to try and break free and find your own independence. If you're a parent, you know what it's like to see someone you love, like, grow up and put aside their childish things. In this case, it's a literal act, but you know, you can do that. And if you're a grown person that's had to do that yourself, even if you don't have children, you can relate to what it's like to put things aside or grow out of things, you know? So there's definitely a lot of relatability to Toy Story 3, no matter which end of the spectrum you're at. But with Brave, do you get the same? Can someone enjoy it as thoroughly if they don't have kids, or if they're not married? I mean, is that still?
I think it's, you know, it's a message that if you've watched a mother daughter relationship up close, it's a little bit more poignant.
Uh-huh.
But at the heart of it, the real tension here, and the true message of this film is that moment when we begin to reach common ground with our parents,
right,
and see them as more than just the person who just tells me I can't do this,
mm-hmm.
or is, you know, it's that moment when you go, oh, it's, you know, every teenager goes through that. You don't understand me,
right?
You know, you don't know my pain because
right.
you've been 40 forever. But you know, every kid goes through that, and as we get older, we all have that moment where we begin to recognize, oh, this is why my parents did this,
yeah.
You know? So I think that's universal, and I think that still resonates.
Thanks for giving your rating on Brave. Sounds like a pretty great movie to see if you get a chance. I'm definitely going to see it. I'm really curious to see if there's some cross-cultural appeal or how it relates to other sort of demographics, I guess, to talk like a marketer. But
so, yeah, I mean, go and see it and prove whether it actually is that good or I have just somehow become Alan Alda.
Right. So, yeah, right. Right.